Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today is the appearance day of Sri Madhvacharya, also Ram Vijayotsava. I think that's going to be covered on Sunday, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Madhvacharya first, and then we'll go to today's verse. So it'll be about 5 minutes before we get to the verse. So I'm going to read from a purport by Srila Prabhupada in the Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhyalila 9246. In this purport, Srila Prabhupada talks about the life and the activities of Madhvacharya, great Acharya in our disciplic succession, and in fact, the head of our Sampradaya. The verse is, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu next arrived at Udupi, the place of Madhvacharya, where the philosophers known as Tattvavadis resided. There he saw the deity of Lord Krishna and became mad with ecstasy. Purport. Sri Madhvacharya took his birth near Udupi, which is situated in the South Kanara district of South India. This is a chief city of the South Kanara province that's near the city of Mangalore, situated to the south of Udupi. Madhvacharya took his birth in the Shivali Brahmin dynasty as the son of Madhyageha Bharat in the year 1040 Shakabda, which is AD 1118. According to some, he was born in the year 1238. So we have about a 100-year discrepancy in the different historical reports of Madhvacharya's appearance. But anyway, it was quite a while ago. It was either 1100 or 1200s. So, which of course is interesting chronologically, because it was a couple hundred years after the appearance of Shankaracharya. And of course, Madhvacharya's main mission was to defeat the impersonalist Mayavadi philosophy of Shankaracharya. Okay, here's a little bit of something about him and his pastimes. In his childhood, Madhvacharya was known as Vasudev, and there are some wonderful stories surrounding him. It says that once his father had piled up many debts, Madhvacharya converted tamarind seeds into actual coins to pay them off. When he was 5 years old, he was offered the sacred thread, so he became a Brahmin at age five. A demon named Maniman lived near his abode in the form of a snake, and at the age of five, Madhvacharya killed that snake with a toe of his left foot. When his mother was very much disturbed, he would appear before her in one jump. He was a great scholar even in childhood, and although his father did not agree, he accepted sannyas at the age of 12. Upon receiving sannyas from Atuta Pariksha, he received the name Purapragnatirtha. After traveling all over India, he finally discussed scriptures with Vijayashankara, the exalted leader of the Sringeri Math. Vijayashankara was actually diminished in the presence of Madhvacharya. In other words, he was defeating the impersonalist philosophers. Accompanied by Satyatirtha, Madhvacharya went to Bhadrak Ashram. It was there that he met Vyasadeva and explained his commentary in the Bhagavad Gita before him. Thus he became a great scholar by studying before Vyasadeva. So if you notice in our disciplic line, it goes from Vyasadeva to Madhvacharya, and of course, you can figure out there's 4,000 years time difference there. So this explains it. Actually, Vyasadeva, being a great soul, a great devotee and yogi, was able to live for many thousands of years. So he was still living in the Himalayas in Bhadrak Ashram, and Madhvacharya traveled there and got darshan of Vyasadeva, so he is considered to be the disciple of Vyasadeva. By the time he came to Anandamath from Bhadrak Ashram, Madhvacharya had finished his commentary in Bhagavad Gita. His companion Satyatirtha wrote down the entire commentary. When Madhvacharya returned from Bhadrak Ashram, he went to Ganjama, which is on the bank of the river Godavari. There he met with two learned scholars named Sobhanabhatta and Swami Shastri. Later, these scholars became known as, in the disciplic succession, Madhvacharya, as Padmanabha Tirtha and Narahari Tirtha. So these are two of the successors in the disciplic line after Madhvacharya, his prominent disciples. When he returned to Udupi, he would sometimes bathe in the ocean. On such an occasion, he composed a prayer in five chapters. Once, while sitting beside the sea, engrossed in meditation upon Lord Sri Krishna, he saw a large boat containing goods from Dwarka was in danger. He gave some signs by which the boat could approach the shore, and it was saved. Another version I read said that he waved something and he parted the sea, or the waves all went in a different direction. He had that kind of power. He gave some signs by which the boat could approach the shore, and it was saved. The owners of the boat wanted to give him a present, and at the time, Madhvacharya agreed to take Gopi Chandan. He received a big lump of Gopi Chandan, and as it was brought to him, it broke apart and revealed a large deity of Lord Krishna. The deity had a stick in one hand and a lump of food in the other. As soon as Madhvacharya received the deity of Krishna in this way, he composed a prayer. The deity was so heavy that not even 30 people could lift it. Yet Madhvacharya personally brought this deity to Udupi. 8 of Madhvacharya's sannyas disciples became directors of his 8 monasteries. Worship of the Lord Krishna deity is still going on at Udupi according to the plans Madhvacharya established. Madhvacharya then went for a second time to visit Bhadrak Ashram. While he was passing through Maharashtra, the local king was digging a big lake for the public benefit. As Madhvacharya passed through that area with his disciples, he was also obliged to help in the excavation. After some time, when Madhvacharya visited the king, he engaged the king in that work and departed with his disciples. So they changed places. After the king spoke with Madhvacharya, he realized he was in the presence of a very exalted soul. Often in the province of Ganga Pradesh, there were fights between Hindus and Muslims. The Hindus were on one bank of the river and the Muslims on the other. Due to the community tension, no boat was available for crossing the river. The Muslim soldiers were always stopping passengers on the other side, but Madhvacharya did not care for these soldiers. He crossed the river anyway, and when he met the soldiers on the other side, he was brought before the king. The Muslim king was so pleased with him, he wanted to give him a kingdom and some money, but Madhvacharya refused. While walking on the road, he was attacked by some dacoits, but by his bodily strength, he killed them all. When his companion, Satyatirtha, was so sometimes he converted the demons and sometimes he killed them. His companion, Satyatirtha, was attacked by a tiger. Madhvacharya separated them by virtue of his great strength. When he met Vyasadeva, he received from him the Shalagam Shila known as Ashtamurti. After this, he summarized the Mahabharata. Madhvacharya's devotion to the Lord and his erudite scholarship became known throughout India. Consequently, the owners of the Sringeri Math, established by Shankaracharya, became a little perturbed. At that time, the followers of Shankaracharya were afraid of Madhvacharya's rising power, and they began to tease Madhvacharya's disciples in many ways. There was even an attempt to prove that the disciplic succession of Madhvacharya was not in line with Vedic principles. A person named Pundarik Puri, a follower of the Mayavadi philosophy of Shankaracharya, came before Madhvacharya to discuss the Shastras. It is said that all of Madhvacharya's books were taken away, but later they were found with the help of King ruler of Kumla. In discussion, Pundarik Puri was defeated by Madhvacharya. A great personality named Truvikramacharya, who was a resident of Vishnumangala, became Madhvacharya's disciple, and his son later became Narayanacharya, the composer of Sri Madhava Vijaya. And that book describes the life and pastimes of Madhvacharya. After the death of Truvikramacharya, the younger brother took sannyas and became known as Vishnutirtha. It was reputed there was no limit to the bodily strength of Purnaprajna Madhvacharya. There was a person named Kandajari who was famed for possessing the strength of 30 men. Madhvacharya placed the big toe of his foot upon the ground and asked the man to separate it from the ground. But the great strong man could not do so, even after great effort. Srila Madhvacharya passed from this material world at the age of 80 while writing a commentary in the Aitreya Upanishad. For further information about Madhvacharya, one should read Madhavijaya by Narayanacharya. Then there's a long list of his disciplic succession, and it says, most of this information is purports available from the South Kannada Manual and the Bombay Gazette. One thing that's very important about Madhvacharya, of course, is not only is he the leading acharya in the representing the Brahma Sampradaya, we call it the Brahma Madhva Sampradaya or Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya after Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but he was very important in establishing the philosophy of Vaishnavism. As we know, due to the killing of animals and the misuse of the Vedas, Lord Buddha appeared, and he stopped the killing of animals. But he also did so by rejecting the Vedas, and more or less came up with the, you know, with the philosophy of Buddhism, or basically everything is nothing. So then Shankaracharya came. Shankaracharya was actually a partial incarnation of Lord Shiva, we understand. And he established, and he threw out Buddhism and reestablished the Vedas, but did so by establishing monism, or impersonal Mayavadi philosophy. Then a couple hundred years later, Madhvacharya appeared, and then Ramanujacharya and others, and they completely defeated Mayavadi philosophy throughout India. So Madhvacharya's philosophy is called Shuddha Dvaita, or pure dualism. And it says, this is from a Back to Godhead magazine article, said he proved logically that God is always a person and always distinct from his creation. And so therefore, thus Madhvacharya's teaching is called also Tattvavada. Tattva means truth, vada means philosophy. So Madhva, it says here, Madhva prepared the way for Lord Chaitanya, who appeared 2 centuries later in the same line of spiritual masters. Lord Chaitanya is the incarnation of Krishna, who spread the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra throughout India and ordered his followers to spread it to every town and village in the world. To fulfill this order, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada came to America in 1965 and founded the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Under his guidance, we, his disciples, are carrying on this mission, but we must give all credit to him and the other spiritual masters in the Brahma, Madhva, Gaudiya, the cyclic chain, including, of course, Madhvacharya. Jai, Srila Madhvacharya ki jai. So, we're going to return to our verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10:51, 1 through 6. Oh, I think we also have to read the introduction, don't we? Is that part of today's introduction? Does anybody know? Okay, a lot of reading today. This is chapter 51, The Deliverance of Muchakunda. This chapter describes how Lord Sri Krishna caused Muchakunda to kill Kalayavana with his harsh glance and relates the conversation between Muchakunda and Lord Krishna. After placing his family members safely within the Dwarka fortress, Sri Krishna went out to Mathura. He appeared like the rising moon. Kalayavana saw that Krishna's brilliantly effulgent body matched Narada's description of the Lord, and thus the Yavana knew he was the personality of Godhead. Seeing that the Lord carried no weapons, Kalayavana put his own weapons aside and ran toward him from behind, wanting to fight with him. Sri Krishna ran for the Yavana, staying just barely beyond Kalayavana's grasp at every step, and eventually leading him a long distance toward a mountain cave. As Kalayavana ran, he hurled insults at the Lord, but he could not grasp him, since his stock of impious karma was not yet depleted. Sri Krishna entered the cave, whereupon Kalayavana followed after him and saw a man lying on the ground. Taking him for Sri Krishna, Kalayavana kicked him. Big mistake. The man had been sleeping for a very long time, and now having been violently awakened, he looked around angrily in all directions and saw Kalayavana. The man stared harshly at him, igniting a fire in Kalayavana's body, in a moment burning him to ashes. Krishna designs all these pastimes so cleverly, doesn't he? It serves so many different purposes, you know, all at once. So, anyway. This extraordinary person was the son of Mandata's name, Muchakunda. He was devoted to Brahminical culture and was always true to his vow. Previously, he had spent many long years helping to protect the demigods from the demons. When the demigods had eventually obtained Kartikeya as their protector, they allowed Muchakunda to retire, offering him any boon other than liberation, which only Lord Vishnu can bestow. Muchakunda had chosen from the demigods the benediction of being covered by sleep, and thus since then he had been lying asleep within the cave. Upon Kalayavana's immolation, Sri Krishna showed himself to Muchakunda, who was struck with wonder at seeing Krishna's incomparable beauty. Muchakunda asked Lord Krishna who he was, and also explained to the Lord his own identity. Muchakunda said, after growing weary from remaining awake for a long time, I was enjoying my sleep here in the cave when some stranger disturbed me, and suffering the reactions of his sins, was burnt to ashes. O Lord, O vanquisher of all enemies, it is my great fortune I now have the vision of your beautiful form. Lord Sri Krishna then told Muchikunda who he was and offered him a boon. The wise Muchikunda, understanding the futility of material life, asked only that he might be allowed to take shelter of Lord Krishna's lotus feet. Pleased at this request, the Lord said to Muchikunda, my devotees are never enticed by material benedictions offered to them. Only non-devotees, namely yogis and speculative philosophers, are interested in material benediction, having mundane desires in their hearts. My dear Muchikunda, you will have perpetual devotion to me. Now always remain surrendered to me. Go perform penances to eradicate the sinful reactions incurred from the killing you had to do in your role as a warrior. In your next life, you will become a first-class Brahmin and attain me. Thus the Lord offered Muchikunda his blessings. So today we're reading texts 1 through 6. These are all together as one long set of verses in translation. So let's just do text 1 responsively. Shri Shukuvacha Tanvilokya Vinishkrantam Ujjihanam Ivodupam Darshaniyatamam Shamam Pita Kosheya Vasasam Shri Shukuvacha Tandilokya Vinishkrantam Ujjihanam Ivodupam Darshaniyatamam Shamam Pita Kosheya Vasasam Shri Shukuvacha Anvilokya Vinishkrantam Ujjihanam Ivodupam Darshaniyatamam Shamam Pita Kosheya Vasasam Ladies. Mam shamam Pita Koshai. Okay, let's do the word for word for just that first verse. Shri Shukuvacha. Shukadeva Goswami said, Tam, him, Dilokya, seen. Vinishkrantam, coming out. Ujjihanam, rising. Iva, as if. Udapam, the moon. Darshaniyatamam, the most beautiful to behold. Shamam, dark blue. Pitta, I'm sorry, it's Pitta's father. Pitta, yellow. Kosheya, silk. Vasasam, whose garment? Okay, I think because we've had so much reading, we'll just go to the translation. Shukadev Goswami said, Kalyavana saw the Lord come out from Mathura like the rising moon. The Lord was most beautiful to behold with his dark blue complexion and yellow silk garments. Upon his chest he bore the mark of Srivatsa, and the Kostova gem adorned his neck. His forearms were sturdy and long. He displayed his ever-joyful lotus face, with eyes pink like lotuses, beautifully effulgent cheeks, a pristine smile, and glittering shark-shaped earrings. The barbarian thought, this person must indeed be Vasudev, since he possesses the characteristics Narada mentioned. He is marked with Srivatsa. He has four arms. His eyes are like lotuses. He wears a garland of forest flowers, and he is extremely handsome. He cannot be anyone else. Since he goes on foot and unarmed, I will fight with him without weapons. Resolving thus, he ran after the Lord, who turned his back and ran away. Kalyavana hoped to catch Lord Krishna, though great mystic yogis cannot attain him. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Although Kalyavana was seeing Lord Krishna with his own eyes, he could not adequately appreciate the beautiful Lord. Thus, instead of worshiping Krishna, he attacked him. Similarly, it is not uncommon for modern men to attack Krishna in the name of philosophy, law and order, and even religion. Om Jnana Tivarandasya Jnanajana Salakaya Chakshirumi Tamayana Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah Panchakalpa Trivishcha Kripasindu Vivacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. So, very nice description of the beauty of Krishna is given here. Kalyavana saw this beautiful form of Krishna, and he completely appreciated it and understood that these were all the qualities and characteristics of Vishnu. This must indeed be Vishnu Narayan. Therefore, I'll attack and kill him. So this is the nature of the demoniac mentality. Even upon seeing Krishna, he had no appreciation for him. He couldn't understand this was Krishna or the proper relationship he should have with Krishna. So, but he did have at least the, I guess you could say, the decency or the sense of fair sporting spirit that since Krishna had no weapons, he put down his weapons, so it'd be a fair fight. So I guess that was one good quality he had. And then, of course, he's now, Krishna immediately runs away, probably a little perplexing to Kalyavana, and Kalyavana goes to chasing him, and he just can't quite catch him. And, of course, as we read from the summary, he will lead him to the cave to become burned to ashes by Muchikunda, all part of Krishna's plan. So, devotees can appreciate Krishna, non-devotees cannot appreciate, even upon seeing Krishna. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport to this verse, he says, those who are qualified by devotion can appreciate the beauty of Krishna. The demons, however, because of their inimical attitude, cannot taste the beauty of Krishna even if the Lord appears before their eyes. To show that fact, this verse describes the beauty of Krishna as he stood before Kalyavana. So in other words, this is a very clear indication of the principle of the non-devotee or the demon not being able to appreciate Krishna, because there's such a vivid description of Krishna's beauty that even Kalyavana appreciated and understood, but still could not accept Krishna. Of course, we hear from the Bhagavad Gita 9:11, Avajananti mam mudha manushim tanamashita paramba vamajananto mamabhuta maheshvaram. Fools deride me when I descend in this human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. So Krishna confirms this, that this is not surprising. This is to be expected, that those who don't understand Krishna, they are very foolish. And so that even when he is in this human form of life, they cannot understand him. And in fact, because he is in a human form, they become even more bewildered because they assume he is just like everybody else. And they don't understand his transcendental body. Here's a room conversation. Srila Prabhupada explained this to a gentleman, Mr. Dayani. Mr. Dayani asked, how then can God come in a human form? Because human, when you talk of a human body, it is limited. It's actually a good question, fairly intelligent. If he comes in a human form, but we know a human form is limited, and in Krishna, God is unlimited. So how can this be? Prabhupada says, he does not come in a human form. He is like a human being. So we could say a human-like form he comes in. The Vijabhuj, it's transcendental. That is also explained in the Bhagavad Gita. In the Bible, it is said that man is made after God. The human being, two hands, two legs, this body they have got, that is the original form of God. But because he comes in that form, avajananti mam mudha manushim tanamashritam, they think that he is a man. His original form is like that. But because we are habituated to seeing two hands, two legs of a human being, we take him as a human being. But that is his original form. God is omnipotent, almighty. He can take any form he likes. You cannot check him. You cannot say how Brahman can come in a human form. Why can he not come? If he is all-powerful, where is the difficulty? So it's a simple logic that that Srila Prabhupada refutes this. In other words, saying, how could God come in a human form? Why can't he? God is omnipotent. God is all-powerful. He is unlimited. He can come in any form he likes. Further, it's explained that this human-like form, or which has similar features externally, of course, is totally spiritual, is actually Krishna's original form. We know that this form that we see of Krishna with two hands, two legs, this is God's original form. This is his sarup. And therefore, when it's said that man is made in God's image, this is actually true. So in other words, anthropomorphism is a philosophy or an idea that we attribute human-like attributes to God. But it is not that. It is actually the other way around. It's not that because we look like this, we think God looks like that. No, it's because God has his original form and features. And, we are, expanded energies from that. We also have similarly looking features. Although, of course, Krishna's body, as he describes throughout Bhagavad Gita, is totally transcendental and spiritual, where ours is made of material elements. So Krishna covers the non-devotees, so they're not allowed to see him. How could those people, the many people who saw Krishna throughout his pastimes, look right at him and not understand who this is? Because Krishna covers them with his yogamaya potency. Bhagavad Gita 7.25 says, I am never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. For them I am covered by my internal potency, yoga maya is the word, and therefore they do not know that I am unborn and infallible. So very few people, Prabhupada explained, maybe a handful of people could understand who Krishna was, even in his present. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, when Krishna was present, there were only a few people who could understand him to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this internal potency, yoga maya, covers the non-devotees. Of course, the yogamaya potency for the devotees expands our appreciation of Krishna's pastimes. Yogamaya has both a bewildering potency for the non-devotees, so they cannot understand Krishna, and yogamaya sometimes acts to bewilder the devotees so that they can more appreciate Krishna and serve him. Just as we see so many examples throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna's pastimes, when Mother Yashoda saw Krishna's universal form, she became bewildered. She was saying, who is this person? I'm thinking I'm his mother and this is my son. Actually, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And she becomes very philosophical. But this is disturbing to her. And it's disturbing to Krishna. It's disturbing the rasa, the wonderful loving vatsala relationships that's there. So Krishna then expands his yogamaya energy to cover Madhya Yashoda. So she once again is no longer a philosopher, but becomes his mother. And enjoys this wonderful, loving relationship of mother and son. So, yogamaya has both qualities, or has, I guess you could say, two different jobs. Yogamaya covers the non-devotees so they cannot understand Krishna, and it also sometimes covers the devotees so they can better appreciate and enjoy their rasa with Krishna. So God is not so easily seen. He only reveals himself, and he reveals himself to his devotees. Bhakti mam abhijananti yavanyas chasmi tat pataha tatpo mam tapato gyatvam vishate tadanantaram, 1855. One can understand me as I am, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, only by devotional service. And when one is full consciousness of me in such devotion, he can enter into the kingdom of God. So in this verse, of course, 1855 and also 1154, very similar verse, Krishna is very clear, very clearly describes how one can know the Supreme. It's not ambiguous, it's not hidden, it's not a mystery. You know, it's not like, you know, people make out that spiritual life is some strange mystery that we will never know. No, actually, Krishna could not be more clear than he is in the Bhagavad Gita. Do you want to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead? You can do so by devotional service. And through that service, one can fully know Krishna as the Supreme, and one can understand one's relationship of loving service to him through that. So this nature of devotional service is explained in the Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu, and also helps to understand a little bit more of some of the subtleties of today's verse. Of course, very famous verse 1111, Anyabhilashita Shunyam, Yana Karmanya Navrita, Anukulyena Krishana, Shilanam Bhaktir Uttama. So there's two very important words, and of course this is the essence of devotional service, as described by Rupa Goswami. This is more or less the definition of what is devotional service. So there's two very important words that explain devotional service. Of course, the first two lines, actually first one line, basically say what devotional service is not. It's devoid of jnana, karma, and other such activities, such as yoga, jnana, karma, jnanavrita. Then the final two lines explain what it is. Bhaktiruttama, the highest devotional service, and there's two important words, anukulyena and anushilanam. It's actually Krishna anushilanam. But anushilanam means continuous devotional service. And to whom? Krishna, Krishna anushilanam. So continuous devotional service, This is the essence of bhakti. And then it's modified by the word anukulyena, which means favorable. And this is an important word. It has to be favorable service. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in his purport to the verse in Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu, says that this anukulyena is more than just saying it's pleasing to Krishna. It has to be in a favorable mood. And he gives some examples why just saying pleasing to Krishna would not be sufficient. He says the demons give pleasure to Krishna by fighting, but it's not bhakti because they're not favorable. Similarly, sometimes Mother Yashoda has to put down Krishna and go attend to the boiling milk. And so Krishna's not pleased and he becomes angry, but it's still bhakti. In fact, it's the highest bhakti. So that is why when we understand bhakti, it has to be in this favorable mood. It has to be in a sense, in a way that we are wanting to serve Krishna and please Krishna and feeling, it's also described as being not hostile. There can't be any hostility towards Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada explains this also in the Nectar of Devotion, in the introduction. He explains this verse. Now, interesting part of the Nectar Devotion, I just figured this out recently, because I was always looking for these verses in the first chapter, and they're not in the first chapter. Srila Prabhupada actually starts the Nectar Devotion at verse 17 of the Nectar Devotion. Verses 1 through 16 are in the introduction. Just a small point to keep in mind. So this very important Anyabhilashita Shunya verse is explained in the introduction, where Prabhupada says, talking about Sandhukulyena, devotional service means to prosecute Krishna consciousness activities which are favorable to the transcendental pleasure of the Supreme Lord Krishna. And any activities which are not favorable to the transcendental favor of the Lord cannot be accepted as devotional service. For example, great demons like Ravana, Kamsa, and Hiranyakasipu were always thinking of Krishna, but they were thinking of him as their enemy. This sort of thinking cannot be accepted as bhakti or Krishna consciousness. So this is somewhat similar to our situation in today's verse, where Kalyavana is very much thinking of Krishna. He's seen Krishna. He's understanding the beauty of Krishna, but he still thinks of him as his enemy that he needs to fight and attack. So this is the unfortunate condition of the non-devotees, that they are not in this favorable mood towards Krishna. So this difference between the devotee and non-devotee is the attitude of service. This is what bhakti is, having that favorable attitude. So materialist always looks to how they can benefit, how they can get ahead, how can they enhance their personal interest. And this bit even falls over into the realm of religion and philosophy and spirituality. We see very few cases where religions or spiritual practices are not self-oriented or self-centered, but are really aimed at pure devotional service to God. This is a very rare characteristic of this philosophy of Bhakti Yoga, that everything one does is aimed towards God's service, and there is no self-interest. Now, we might say, well, I may have some self-interest. We're in a process of purification. But the process is pure. The process is one of pure devotional service. And Srila Prabhupada gave us the instructions and the process by which we will become purified gradually to reach that stage of pure devotional service where there is no self-interest and only the interest in serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So devotees see how they can serve God and how they can serve others, how they can serve other devotees. This is our process of purification, to reach the point of being able to fully understand our relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it begins with practical engagement of the senses. The Bhaktivinoda Sindhu 1.2.2.34, I think it's originally from the Padma Purana or another Purana, gives this verse, Atak Sri Krishna Nama Di Nabhati Grahyam Indriya Sevan Mukhya Hijivada Swayameva Sparatida. Therefore, material senses cannot appreciate Krishna's holy name, form, qualities, and pastimes. When a conditioned soul is awakened to Krishna consciousness and renders service by using his tongue to chant the Lord's holy name and to taste the remnants of the Lord's food, the tongue is purified and one gradually comes to understand who Krishna really is. So again, this process of utilizing the material senses, the material body, everything in Krishna's service is emphasized as the practice of bhakti yoga. Jiva Goswami also describes this. He describes two forms of bhakti in his commentary to Bhaktivinoda Sindhu 1.1.11. He says there are two forms of bhakti. One is called bhava-rupa, which is the emotional form, where one's emotions are fully engaged in connection with Krishna. But this is found usually at the stage of bhava. So, for the rest of us who are not at the stage of bhava, there is the active form of devotional service called chaste-rupa bhakti. And Jiva Goswami says this chaste-rupa bhakti means that we use the body, the words, and the mind in Krishna's service. So this is sadhana bhakti. This is the process that Srila Prabhupada gave us. And Srila Prabhupada definitely emphasized activity in Krishna consciousness. There's no question of that. Prabhupada engaged us in so many ways because he knew that we were very covered, we were very much in the modes of passion and ignorance, we had very restless minds, our minds are hard to control. So it requires constant engagement. We have to engage everything in Krishna's service. Just as the other verse was saying, that we begin by engaging the tongue. And the tongue is engaged by taking prasadam. That's fairly easy for most of us. I've always found that to be, you know, one of those easier practices in devotional life. And except for the first temple I was at, where the prasadam was so bad, I can't believe it. When I joined the movement, I was probably had the only temple that had terrible prasadam. It was so bad that my wife and I thought that taking prasadam was an austerity, like getting up early in the morning, taking cold showers, eating prasadam. We thought it was one of the austerities. Then somehow or another, we went to another temple and got a whole different realization. I don't know how I lasted, you know, but because Prasadam is really wonderful, and Prasadam brings people to Krishna consciousness, keeps people to Krishna consciousness, but we are strained from the point. At any rate, we begin using the tongue in taking Prasadam and chanting the holy name, chanting Hare Krishna. So these processes of engaging the senses, and Prabhupada explained how the chanting of Hare Krishna fully engages the senses. You're engaging the tongue, you're engaging speech, you're engaging hearing, even on your japa beads, you're engaging the sense of touch. And if you're in kirtan, you might be engaging your whole body in dancing, or some of us too old to dance, but you know, whatever, you know, move around a little bit. And we engage ourselves, you know, completely, all of our senses, in absorption in the holy name. You know. And this needs to be done with enthusiasm. Sometimes we might understand all the points of Krishna consciousness and we sort of get it. Yes, we do sadhana bhakti and we understand it. We've heard it all for years and years. But we may not have that enthusiasm in our execution of Krishna consciousness. And there's a nice description of this enthusiasm, which also ties in with this idea of active service that Prabhupada gives in the Nectar of Instruction. This word utsaha means enthusiasm. So it's described that Prabhupada says, endeavor executed with intelligence in Krishna consciousness is called utsaha, or enthusiasm. Endeavor executed with intelligence. The devotees find the correct means by which everything can be utilized in the service of the Lord, yukta vairagya. The execution of devotional service is not a matter of idle meditation, but practical action in the foreground of spiritual life. Some of these purports, Prabhupada's words, are just, you know, they're just so perfect. You know, this is, it just really, really explains it. This just hits it. Execution of devotional service is not a matter of idle meditation, but practical action in the foreground of spiritual life. In other words, you have to do something for Krishna. We don't sit idly meditating or attempting to meditate or imitate meditating, but we do some devotional service practically for Krishna, for our spiritual master. And in that way, all of the body, the words, and the mind become purified. And they become Krishnaized. Just as the Prabhupada always gave the example of the iron rod put in the fire, eventually you take it out, and it has all the qualities of fire, still an iron rod, but it gives heat and light and all qualities of fire. So in the same way, even though we're in these material bodies and have these material senses, when they become in contact with Krishna and Krishna's energies, then they become spiritualized and will take on those qualities of Krishna and the spiritual energy. So we simply have to execute Krishna consciousness in this favorable mood, following the orders of our spiritual master, performing our chaste rupta bhakti, using the body, the minds, and the words in the Lord's service, until eventually we will get to the point of being able to see Krishna, understand Krishna perfectly, and be perfectly surrendered in our execution of bhakti yoga. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. And there's some questions, comments, thoughts. Oh, we have a few. Okay, I saw Trivikram, and then we'll go to the... Go right ahead. Sure. Oh. Okay, we have Radharaman Mahaprasad. So right after class, we'll make sure we get it. Thank you for letting us know that. Very good. And a good tie-in there, favorable devotional service, using the tongue, yes. Okay, we had Trivikram and Janmashtami.
Very nice class. So we're speaking about favorable devotional service. During the Rajasuya, when the Lord killed Shishupala and merged into the Lord, Yudhishthira said, this rascal was so envious of Krishna, and yet he merged into the body of the Lord. How is this, Narad? What happened? And so Narad said, well,
you probably know the story better than I do.
Yeah. So, but the idea is, what he said, the way we're seeing things, you know, it's different, duality, you know. opposites. He says the Lord does not see that way.
The Lord was not what?
He does not see in the, you know, like
doesn't see to help.
Yeah. So, but yet, I mean, even to that, I still think there is a vast difference here between Shishupal merging in the Lord or Putana becoming the, what, the Norse or whatever, really. There's still some difference. I don't know if you want to go a little higher than that.
Well, I think you're making the point that there are different results, different devotees or different non-devotees receive from Krishna. Krishna says that he's equal to all, but at the same time, of course, he's favorable to his devotees. So the non-devotees rarely get personal relationship with him, and they may become liberated, they may become free from their material contamination, they may get impersonalment, and that Shishupala, of course, merged in the body of the Lord, which is quite astounding. That's very unusual. And of course Shishupala is Jaya or Vijaya, one of them, you know, he's an eternal associate of Krishna in the spiritual world. And the example of Putana is a great exception. I can't think of any other demon that got to go to Krishna Leela and become, like I said, like a nurse or a mother and gain that position. Of course, there's always a backstory, you know, how all these things happen and you know, why she got that opportunity. But that's also considered to be extremely rare. Sometimes we see in the Bhagavatam, incidents are given which are exceptions. In fact, they're sort of discussed in that way to show us that these are exceptions. This isn't what normally happens. I mean, the average demon that gets killed may get liberation, but doesn't get to go and be like Mother Yashoda in the spiritual world. Anyway, it's a complex topic. Muskin?
A question about Cheshta Rupa and Bhava Rupa Bhakti. I believe, I'm trying to remember which chapter it is, but it's the beginning of a chapter in Nectar Devotion where Prabhupada describes how the desire for liberation and performing, I don't know if he says artificial austerities, hardens the heart. Mm-hmm. And we need a soft heart in order to practice bhakti. So it does seem that, you know, because there's emotional exchanges taking place with Krishna, so it seems like even on the Cheshta Rupa platform, there is some of this going on. You know, we get reciprocation.
Sure.
Wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, it is an interesting point. That part, I forget which chapter it is in Nectar Devotion, but it's in the chapter around the verses where the process. Let's see which one, where is it? No, it's where the description of Yukta Vairagya. It's in that sequence of verses where Yukta Vairagya is discussed, and it's described why actually. Rupa Goswami says Vairagya is not so good because it hardens the heart. You know, and then the question is, but if there isn't a Vairagya, how can one become purified? And that's when he says through Yukta Vairagya, you know, through utilizing everything in Krishna's service, that's sufficient for purification and does not harden the heart, where just too much Vairagya does. That's described by Rupa Goswami. That's a very good point. And then you're saying, is there... Yeah, even in the early stages of sadhana, when we're engaging our senses and everything, is there emotion? Is there, of course, even in the beginning, we get some taste of Krishna consciousness, and that's also described. There's different, you know, a couple different, you know, like para attachment, and there's a couple other terms given Nectar Devotion of how we get even in the beginning stages that early taste of Krishna consciousness. And that's kind of like some special mercy. It's also described, some of that taste is actually the taste that the spiritual master is experiencing, that when we engage in Krishna consciousness and we begin to surrender to the spiritual master, we get a little bit of that. So I forget the Sanskrit term. Somebody, what is it? That's it. Yeah, the Ratyabhasa. And so there's a nice description of that, how that's there. And so, even in the beginning stages, many of us experience when we first start chanting Hare Krishna, you know, like very blissful, or you know, and also remember the very one of the very first stages of bhakti is the diminishing of the suffering, diminishing of the reactions to sinful life. So there's also just that sense of relief, you know, and we know the sense of relief is like pleasure, right? You know, cessation of pain, it's experience like pain. So we're experiencing both. We're experiencing the cessation of pain and suffering, and at the same time, the nectar and the bliss of Krishna consciousness. Yeah, so that's there. Now, of course, that's not going to just last and continue and go on and on and on without a little hard work along the way. So Krishna gives us a nice taste, says, no, you've got to perform a little bit of austerity. You know, you have to perform sadhana to make that permanent, because it's described at the, like the, what was it, the rati, basha, okay, that's flickering. It's not permanent. It's more temporary. So that may go away, and to get, you know, and to really be permanently situated in these stages, higher stages, you know, really takes some time, takes some work in Krishna consciousness. Okay, we're probably out of time. One more, Rania Prabhu.
So in this pastime with Kaliyavana, it's described how he's not sufficiently pious to approach the Lord. And we know from other places in the Shastra that in this age, Lord Chaitanya, especially Lord Nityananda, don't consider our piety. So I'm just wondering, is our lack of piety some kind of special qualification here?
Maybe. Yeah, we didn't have much qualification, did we? Well, Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda came to deliver the most fallen, you know, so, you know, sometimes even devotees have said that, I lay claim, you know, because I'm most fallen. So, yes, we definitely qualify for the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda.
Hare Krishna. So in terms of, you mentioned enthusiasm and Krishna consciousness. So I get that we're individually responsible for ourselves, but is there a responsibility in our leaders for the level of enthusiasm in the devotees under their care?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's both. You know, we have to take individual responsibility. It seems like Prabhupada did say in some of his letters, like the famous letter to Karandar, he mentions things like that, how in Krishna consciousness, the leaders, we need to give, you know, like fresh challenge and to enthuse and to encourage the devotees. So yeah, it's partly the response. That's one of the responsibilities of leadership, is to try to encourage and enthuse the devotees. And Prabhupada said you do that by giving challenges in Krishna consciousness. In other words, by, you know, increasing devotional service opportunities is the way I would interpret it. Yeah, I think we could, all of us could do better at that. All of us could do better at encouraging one another and creating those opportunities and trying to, you know, really involve the devotees in devotional service. At the same time, each devotee for ourselves, you know, we should take personal responsibility. And see, if I'm not enthusiastic, why not? What are the reasons, you know? And, you know, we can look in the scriptures and Srila Prabhupada's writings and we can see some of those, you know, that are fairly obvious, like, are we associating with devotees? Are we chanting our rounds? Are we hearing the philosophy? Are we engaging in service? Those kind of things. And, you know, if still there's some lingering problems, then, you know, speak with senior devotees that you trust and that you, you know, feel confident in their guidance and we try to help one another if there are difficulties where we're not feeling enthusiastic. That happens to everybody. You know, we all go through times when we're feeling a little more enthusiastic, a little less enthusiastic. That's not unexpected. You know, and there is a certain point where we persevere through those times of, I would say, low enthusiasm. In other words, by our intelligence and our dedication to Prabhupada and his instructions, and our understanding, that's why we have to really be grounded in philosophy. Because if we're really grounded in the philosophy, then if there is some time where we're not feeling so blissful, enthusiastic, we know what to do. We know to continue our duties and continue in Krishna consciousness and try to do those things which will revive that enthusiasm again. Okay, we should quit now. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.